Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is journalist and author Tanya Sweeney, whose debut novel, Esther Is Now Following You, is out now with Penguin. Tanya, I always start with this question because I always want to bring people back to when they were small, when they were children. And I would love to know what you were like as a little girl and what school was like for you, and maybe when you came to reading and books, and if you remember a special book from that time in your life.
Sure. I mean, it's an interesting one. I was born about 2 months early, right? And I was 2 pounds, 2 ounces when I was born and had encephalitis. So drama from the very first hour of life, basically. And I always kind of thought, my mum always told me about my kind of, you know, birth story and how I just shot out of nowhere. And I always sort of took that as being like, you know, gosh, well, I'm a driven little thing. And I like to, you know, I like to be early now. Like every preemie, I love a nap. Oh my God, we're crazy for naps, premature babies. But, you know, when I got to school, first day of school, I think I sat on the teacher's desk, if you don't mind. Well, my best friend was crying away. I was like, what's up with her, you know? Because I'd never gone to play school or anything like that. So, and loved learning from the get-go, loved it, and was a lovely little rule follower. I'm sure I was a little pleasure to teach, you know? And I do remember books landing, you know, I can't say now I remember my parents reading to me or anything like that, but I think as soon as I got the hang of it, I was definitely the kind of kid who would read in the dark, and I would have that little shaft of light from the hallway, and I would bring the book through the shaft, you know, of light, you know, late. I remember always having about 7-8 books in the bed with me at all times. So I loved to read, and I always figured, you know, as soon as I realized somebody was writing books and that it was a human being that came up with a story and put it into a book, I was like, right, that's the one, that's the job for me. So of course, I used to start all these stories in copybooks, and I'd get a page and a half in and I'd be like, right, so Barbara Cartland made loads of money doing this. I'm going to make so much money. So I think about the pool it was going to have at the tennis court. And then, of course, the book would never finish. And sure, it was like that for 40-odd years. But I do remember, you know, and I think I went through pretty much the same as most Irish kids, you know, the garden gang. And obviously, you know, Blighton was massive in our house. And, you know, went on to Sweet Valley High. But I really think it was like the Judy Bloom kind of books that really landed in on me. I think I understood on some level that Judy Bloom was writing to kids as though they were kind of serious people. Mm-hmm. It was not a cutesy wootsy story. She really did respect her very young readership. Mm-hmm. And she wrote to them without, you know, it was accessible and there was challenging material, challenging issues, but it was done with such lightness of touch. And I remember responding to that at maybe 8 or 9. I think Super Fudge might have been the first one I read. And I remember the protagonists were kind of, they were the same age as me as we kept going up, you know. So I think Deanie was 13. I can't remember the character's name, and Tiger Eyes was 15. You know, I think we went up to about 17 with Forever, didn't we? Or maybe 18. Catherine was 18 in Forever. Yeah, I do remember the Judy Bloom stuff just being incredible. I was addicted to it. I couldn't get enough. You know, I mean, had she written 100 more, I would have been delighted with myself.
And was that, did she sort of introduce you to kind of being aware of your own desire and things like that? Because that was the case for some people, but there wasn't an awful lot of kind of education around that sort of thing growing up, or was that not?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do remember going into my first year of secondary school and we'd all already read Forever, of course. So there was a dog-eared copy, wink, wink, knocking around the class. And we were all like, been there, done that. So yeah, I do remember being on, I won't say speaking terms with Ralph, but I knew who Ralph was from the age of about 11 and 12. And again, it was the first time I'd really... Now, of course, every Irish girl had already read Flowers in the Attic, Ho Ho, and Riders and Rivals and all the stuff off Mum's bookshelf. I mean, it is kind of incredible how we learned about sex from these fantastic Jackie Collins bonkbusters. I mean, I suppose we were screwed from the get-go, really, weren't we? We'd some fierce expectations of ourselves.
Oh, you write a lot about sex, and Esther is now following you, your debut novel, actually. I was saying to you before we started the chat how I love the sex scenes in this, the bad sex, the and the masturbation, all of it is like, it's so funny and so real and like so awkward sometimes. Did you enjoy writing those parts?
Brilliant. It's so funny because so many people have come to me and said, there's a lot of sex and masturbation in your book. And I'm like, there's actually not. I don't know. I think I took out a number of scenes. I mean, when Esther gets to Canada, it's no spoiler to say she goes to Canada in search of the actor she has a massive crush on. And there's a bit of sex there. And I think I remember putting in more sex. Mm. And again, it was that Lena Dunham type sex where she's like, well, I'm a free spirited sexual libertine, and I'm just going to do it all. And of course, guys are like, happy days, will you do that? You know? And of course, she's like, yeah, why not? Cosmo told me it's my job to keep you happy. And I always find that, I mean, I'm writing my next book now, and I find the Cosmo-raised generation of women, of sexually active women, just fascinating. I mean, God help us, in fairness. You know?
I love some of Esther's train of thought, you know, mid-sex, and there's one, and she's, well, it was what was, well, she was wondering, like, who was the first person ever to think of giving a blowjob? Or necessarily, and these are the kind of things she thinks about, like, during some of the kind of more pedestrian sex with her husband at the start. But, like, yeah, love that. Or just some of the philosophical ruminations that she's going through during it. Anyway, sorry, we'll get back to the books here. But, yeah, just thinking about, yeah, we kind of grew up on that dial of those books, didn't we? You mentioned earlier when you were talking about your childhood that you were a good little rule follower. So were you a good little rule follower then when you went into secondary school, or did you sort of turn into a bit of a rebel, or what were you like?
It was so interesting because in my primary school, I was in one of these little country Irish schools, right, where there were three classes in every classroom. So there would have been fourth, fifth, sixth class. And I was a massive reader. And my teachers used to send me off to the other classes to read my essays, which was obviously mortifying because you were maybe in second class and going up to the third, fourth, fifth class, they'd be looking at you going, swat, you know? And, but I remember, and I think I was kind of left to my own devices in primary school. I do remember doing a lot of reading from the library in class. I don't know how I was allowed to get away with that, right? So when I went into secondary school, I kind of carried on to my liking as well without realizing that I had a lot to learn. It was a different speed. I went into secondary school. I didn't know a sinner in my new school. Yeah. Everyone else had gone to local schools. I went to a school that was a little bit further out. And I do remember being obsessed. I said this to someone recently. I kind of forgot to learn because I was so busy looking around at everyone going, what's their buzz? What's their deal? Who are they friends with? What are they like? And so, like, I was just obsessed with all these new people and the politics of the classroom. Went home to my, after getting, you know, straight A's all the way through primary school, went home with a report card of E's and F's to my mother, who had an absolute fit. And yeah, I started to rebel a lot. I think I tried to fit in a little bit, you know, and was going home and begging for all the fancy clothes that everyone wore uniformly in my year, you know, the Levi's sweatshirts and the Pepe jeans and the penny loafers and all the rest of it. I'm a child of the 90s. And I think at one point I went, you know what, you can opt out and you can do this in style. And I just went pure cure head and went and just was like tasseled skirts and sod your Pepe sweatshirts. Stacey is there now, Pepe. And I really did opt out. And I think after, you know, when I got to like fifth year, I'd sort of really leaned into being the troublemaker, you know. I was never getting any kind of praise from teachers. I was never being nurtured as, you know, or doing any kind of after school activities. I was a total like burnout, you know. And there was a couple of us who were sort of just in between. You know, we weren't the posh snobs and we were not the nerds. You know, we were kind of in the middle, and we used to watch a lot of MTV in the language lab during lunchtime. And that was kind of what I was like in school. And I do remember reading, but it was only in the like last year of secondary school that one teacher turned around and went, you're actually a really great writer. You know, maybe this is something you should think about pursuing, because no one had ever said it to me. I mean, most of my teachers in secondary school came at me with eye rolls going, she's still here. When is she graduating? She's wearing pajamas to class now. I mean, what, you know, I think I wore pajamas to my graduation, actually. But yeah, I was not ever, I don't think, you know, anyone in my school thought I was going to do too much, you know. I think if I stayed out of jail, they would have been pleasantly surprised.
That's interesting, those that you were saying about you, because it's often, I mean, I'm not giving you any kind of diagnosis here, but it's often noted that people who maybe have are a little bit neurodiverse do really, really well at primary school, and often their grades plummet in the first year of secondary. It's all this, the kind of social fitting in and everything is quite sort of across the board. I just thought it was interesting to see, because if you're getting straight A's in your primary school and then you get getting E's and F's in secondary school, it's an interesting sort of dynamic.
So, and I've never been diagnosed with anything, you know, but I mean, I always just chalked it down to the fact that I was really drunk on, and again, back to Enid Blyton, it was a part boarding school, part day school. So I was just intoxicated by the dorms and the, you know, dining halls and all that. And I just forgot I was there to learn, really, you know, and that's, and then just catching up. That was the other thing I never did. I never did my homework. I never wrote it into the school diary. Of course, in second year, I got found with all my empty copybooks and my empty school diary. And I got the hairdryer treatment of the teacher. I mean, it was the episode talked of for days in our year, you know. But I'm glad she caught me, because, I mean, I would have come out knowing nothing, really, had I kept going.
You know? So you said the hairdryer treatment there.
That's, do you remember how they used to call that, when Alex Ferguson used to scream at players and he'd just be like, you know, the hair, you'd just be like, you know, hot hair in your face. Oh,
for a minute there, I thought this was some kind of horrific, you know, corporal punishment. I was like, oh, everyone knows what this is. It must be a boarding school thing. No, okay, yeah. Right. I'm glad for you now. So you weren't reading really very much at all then during secondary school, because you were going through this whole sort of period of rebellion and all the rest of it. That I'm sorry, the system failed you, Tanya. But anyway, but you were going through all of that. And then you said towards the end of school, a teacher like recognized this kind of talent in you. So you were writing if you weren't reading. Like, can you remember it? Like, did you find your way back into books then after that, like going into college, or like, what, when did they sort of come back into your life in a bigger way than they were?
It's interesting, because at the time I was absolutely obsessed in a really almost unhealthy way with music. So I started to read music biographies and music memoirs and all of this. And I do remember reading Wonderland Avenue by Danny Sugarman. Now, this is a book about a kind of a kid in LA who befriended Jim Morrison back in the 60s and eventually went on to become the Doors' manager after Jim Morrison had died. So he was sort of involved in, you know, legacy management and all the rest of it. And then sort of befriended and later managed Iggy Pop. But he became a heroin addict, but it was all against this incredible Laurel Canyon backdrop. It was glamorous and it was horrific at the same time. And I do remember reading this book, and again, a fantastic storyteller. And it's interesting, because Cameron Crowe released a memoir recently. I don't know if you know it. It was fantastic. The Uncool, I think it was called. And he mentions Danny Sugarman as someone he used to hang out with in the 70s. And, you know, Cameron Crowe, who's now in his 70s, Danny Sugarman died, I think, in his 40s of cancer. But he was saying of Danny Sugarman, he was like, he was just such a tall storyteller. I mean, he just told tall tales. He was obsessed with Jim Morrison. So it was so interesting to hear this, you know, re-examination, we'll say, of what Danny Sugarman was like, you know. But I do remember that book really broke the seal, and I loved reading music memoirs, and I've continued that to this day. I really have. Yeah.
And did that sort of spark any interest in journalism or writing nonfiction? And like, did that kind of pique your interest?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I did always want to be a music journalist in a way. I mean, what, you know, I think I kind of understood in some ways that novels were written by a rarefied kind of talented few. I was not necessarily one of those people. So, and I remember just having such fervor about music. I mean, and so that was sort of the dream, you know. And again, I wasn't confident enough to really go after that immediately. I went, did arts in school, and, you know, friends of mine were going for the civil service exams and all that. So I thought, well, that could be nice, civil service. And yeah, I absolutely devoured music magazines, devoured them. And then thought, maybe that's something I could do. And eventually, you know, I went into the music industry. I moved to London to do my master's in journalism. And I moved into the music industry, working in MTV and, wow. and record companies. And this is where the germ of Esther Is Now Following You yeah. came from, you know, just seeing all these super fans. And I was like, God, these people are actually incredible. You know, they're so cunning and smart and, you know, it's amazing. And so I moved home from London and started working for Hot Press. And I mean, I was never as happy as I was writing an album review or a gig review or trying to put into words what I felt about music. I was just in heaven. I really was.
Gosh, that makes sense now, because you write so brilliantly about being in those rooms. Like, I'm at the point in the novel, so we're three quarters of the way through the novel, and I think Esther goes to this party. I don't think I'm spoiling anything here. No, I think she goes to this party where her celebrity, well, he's a rising celebrity really at this point. Mm-hmm. Celebrity crush Ted is going to be there, or she thinks he's going to be there. And she's looking around at the room, and the way you describe that room, and I think you say something like, the self-congratulation was so in the air, it was like condensation.
Yeah, dripping off the walls.
Off the walls. I love that. I mean, just like it nails away. I mean, obviously there's lots more to those situations, and I'm not saying it was your situation in London at all, but just you write with such, I think you've been in those rooms.
I absolutely have. Oh, I've been in rooms where the self-congratulation is just smacking you in the face. Absolutely, yeah.
But also that, well, I don't think I can talk about her yet. I'm not going to name the character, but so you describe a particular character and her beauty and her, I don't know, just the fastidious kind of way she has taken care of herself. She's like this beautiful gazelle. And it was another brilliant line. You have so many brilliant observations about this, but yet there is such a kind of tenderness towards her too. And you know, you write about the likability of this person and the relatability. Like, it's never two-dimensional at all. And that's what I really loved about Esther Is Following You. It's never surface. It's never just one thing. You write with a great deal of complexity about all of these things, but particularly, yeah, the industry, the celebrity world and stuff like that.
That's so lovely to hear, you know. And I think it's interesting, because had I written this book, I mean, I wrote a screenplay about stalking about 25 years ago, you know, in my early 20s. And I think, you know, it's taken me until now, my mid to late 40s, we'll say, to have that compassion or maybe generosity or something. I can't really describe it. I just know if I'd written this book any earlier, I probably would have been a bit more ungenerous. And especially with Esther, I mean, there was a really fine line to divine between, you know, her being really unhinged and doing awful things. I mean, she is amoral, or at least morally grey. But, you know, I had to write about her and hold her in my heart in a way to write about her. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people are responding to. They're like, she's a maniac, but I kind of love her in a way, and I feel for her. So, yeah, I think it probably took me to this point in my life to kind of write like that, I think.
That's a good point. Actually, I think there's a sort of a different kind of empathy that you get to as you get older that you just don't have access to, probably because you've been bashed about by life enough to kind of give everybody a break, no matter who they are, like, you know, how bad they are. But yeah, I love Esther. I'm just beginning to think maybe I am a moral and an awful person, because I related to her quite a bit. I'm like, oh my God. not that I'm a stalker or anything, but there were lots of parts of her that I was like, God, particularly, actually, this is just reminding me of something. You write really well about the sort of performance that some of us do. You know, at one point she's comforting another character, and she's there on the porch, and the dusk is falling, and she can picture herself, and she's like, oh, this would make a great scene if someone saw me being so wonderfully kind. And mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh gosh, that's really on the money there.
And I do wonder, you see, you have to understand, the book is also set in 2010, 2011, when we kind of thought a bit more like that.
That's right.
I remember friends of mine going, when something great is happening to me, I'm also kind of half thinking in the background, how am I going to write about this on Facebook? And I do think our brains got a little bit rewired in those very heady days of social media. And like that, you know, you can see yourself from the outside, or at that, then you could anyway.
Yes.
See yourself from the outside going, this probably looks quite lovely. I probably yes. look like such a great person right now. She's not in the moment. And she's like, I wonder what would happen if somebody I was really interested in might see this, you know? She's not in the moment really comforting the character that she needs to be, you know?
Yes.
There is a self, there's a degree of self-interest there as well, you know? I mean, she is God lover. She's a deluded
yes.
character, and but very human, I think, and very, you know, relatable. Oh.
Absolutely. Very lovable, actually. But just what you were saying there about, but I love the fact that it's set back in 2010 and 2011. And we were so naive about some of the stuff about social media and just, oh my God, the sharing, the lack of, you know, but we were all doing it. So, you know, even like I went, oh, I've forgotten about that, where you talk about the wall and Facebook and just, oh my goodness. We were really just so unguarded.
We were lunatics. We were and I loved writing about that because it was like the Wild West. You'd get a friend request from somebody. It didn't matter who they were. And you just went, well, I'm collecting my friends. So friend, hello. And that's, without spoiling it, this is kind of how Esther manages to get a little bit close to Ted. She starts just friending the people around him, you know. And of course, they, it being 2010, 2011, just blithely accept the friendship request, you know, and soon she's sort of closer to his inner circle. And I just remember, like you say, there was no regard for privacy, for safety. The conversation around stalking and parasocial relationships had never really taken yeah. off. And for about a year there, one glorious little year, celebrities and regular people were kind of on the same plane. There wasn't social media management teams. There wasn't millions of followers. You know, this was at the very start of it all, you know, and you could message, we'll say, Harry Styles or tweet Harry Styles and have him maybe respond. You know, it wasn't outside the realms of possibility. So I think for a while, we really did think they were our buddies. Famous people were kind of our pals. And it wasn't entirely improper or inappropriate to approach them online, which is mad.
It is. It's just, it really does look like absolute insanity when you look back on it. But you capture that moment, you capture that kind of those years, really. It's just, you can nearly smell them. You know, it's just, I feel like
smell the MySpace.
Yeah. But bringing you back just to where we were now with, I think we were in London and you're kind of in the music industry and sounds like really exciting. Was it exciting?
I was in Disney World. I mean, I was working at MTV. Now, like I say, I used to watch MTV in school, you know, well, we'd record it off the telly and bring it into to the school. And going into that office was like going to Alton Towers every single day of the week. I couldn't get over myself. It was a total pinch me situation. And I moved from there into A&R, which is the department in a record company that scouts the bands and then signs the bands and then looks after the bands. So we were very sort of, we'll say, artist facing. And I found out just how the sausage is made, really, you know. And for somebody who was literally obsessed with music, lived, breathed, all of it, to be that close to the process was just beyond joyous, you know. I used to ring up, I mean, she probably shouldn't say this, right? But I'd no money. I mean, I was on absolutely nothing. But I used to ring up because I knew everyone in the late 90s music industry was forever sozzled, right? Copped this on very quickly. So I'd ring up like the higher ups in, we'll say, EMI Records, right? Knowing that they probably wouldn't remember me or know me. And I'd just pretend that I'd met them and that I was like, Malk, hi, it's Tanya from X. And they'd be so embarrassed that they didn't know me. They'd be like, oh, hi, darling. Hi, darling. And I'd be like, Malk, darling, can I get two tickets to Radiohead? Sorry. Oh. And of course, he thought she's somebody. Oh, yeah, no problem, darling. So I did this a lot. I mean, necessity is the mother of invention. I mean, hopefully no one from EMI is going to come at me retrospectively and sue me / bill me. But yeah, I mean, when you're on half nothing and you want to go to bands, I mean, you'll make it happen. I was just, you know, lying my way around the city. It's terrible, really.
And once you saw how the sausage was made, was there any was there any part of you that got, because, you know, like, I know certainly with the writing world and stuff like that, I mean, sometimes it can be easy to get a little bit cynical if you've been in the industry for a while. Did you get a little, was there any part of you that, you know, saw a different side. Yeah, with the curtain pulled back, was there a little bit of disabusing you of your notions about it?
No, in fact, I think it actually made me even more passionate. You know, I did understand that at the end of the day, it was an industry. I was working in, major record labels, you know, and you're hearing more about numbers and spreadsheets and the bottom line and all that. And, you know, you understand on a level that it's not the romantic, oh, I have a good feeling about this band situation. That doesn't really happen. Well, it happens and it doesn't, you know. But no, I mean, I wasn't really in the industry long enough to burn out, you know. I mean, I think I left at the turn of the millennium, there was a sort of dot-com explosion. And I remember getting an opportunity to work as a music supervisor on this interactive film company. And we were told this was the future of filmmaking. So I thought I was at the coal face of the next Disney, you know, that kind of way. I mean, it imploded not long after, and I was kind of high and dry. Back to the labels, you know. Just making that transition from like A&R and scouting to music journalism. I mean, when you're in Dublin, these are very fluid. You can make those transitions pretty quickly and seamlessly, you know. So, and as soon as I got my foot in the door with Hot Press, I mean, that was it. I was just, you know, licking myself.
And is that you just reminded me of another part of the book where Esther says to Anna, she's kind of like, I think, I'm not going to say the character's name because I spoil it, but is she Canadian? I can't remember if she's actually Canadian or whatever. She's quite posh. But Esther says, you know, if they were ice creams, they'd lick themselves or something like that. She's like, I miss the Dublin humour, because she lived in Dublin for a while. And it's like, oh, you like, that's the other thing. There's so much sort of Dublin that comes across in the book as well. But there's so much of London. There's so much of, there's a lovely kind of melting pot of everything in there.
But you've definitely read it, Ruth.
Oh, sorry. Did I get an A? Did I get an A? Have I passed? Did I pass the exam? But sorry, I've lost my train of thought now. Oh, yes, I was going to ask you now. So you said at the millennium, so you've made this switch and you segued into music journalism. And were you back in Dublin then at that point? Did you move back to Dublin from London?
I moved back in 2001. I was working, like I say, in music supervision for a couple of movies, and the films were just taking too long to move into production. So I was kind of struggling. And I think I'd done 5 years in London at that stage. And I was, it's a lonely place if you don't have your, I mean, I did have friends, but I hadn't made that core kind of ride or die set of friends. And all of my Dublin friends were ringing me going, we're going for, you know, we're going to get some cans and go to the canal now. And I was like, oh, I want to be going to the canal with cans. So I kind of made the decision to move back to Dublin. And like I say, I started working in Warner Music first. And after temping for about a year, it took me a while to get myself back in Dublin. So I moved into Warner and then moved into Hot Press. So I was there for, I think I'd been home about a year and a half when I got into Hot Press. Yeah.
And so back to the books that you were reading then, it sounds like you were like, your life was extremely full. So did you have time to read books then, or was it like full on work and researching for work and meeting people and that kind of thing?
Always loved books. I always really enjoyed reading books. And I do remember around that time reading quite a bit of Marion Keyes, actually. And the thing about Marion is, and I've always said this about her, Marion makes writing books look super easy because the style is so fluid and warm and conversational. And I think you read a book like Marion's and you go, I could do that. She is obviously so talented that she makes it look easy. And it's actually incredibly difficult to write like that, you know. But I do remember in my youthful naivety / arrogance going, I'm able to do that, you know. And I do remember, again, the commitment phobia, trying to start a couple of things, tried to write something about the music industry. Again, I wrote something about a stalker with de Clairembault syndrome, which is a disorder where you feel someone is sending you subliminal messages from the telly or radio or whatever. So I started writing things and did a couple of courses and, you know, mixed results there. And, you know, we'll talk about, you know, creative writing courses, pros and cons. But I was always trying to write something. But I do remember reading a lot of those kind of books. I love a contemporaneous novel. I stay in my lane books-wise. I mean, it's terrible, really. I wouldn't know a fantasy novel if it stood up in my soup. I don't tend to read crime. I don't read historical fiction. I love nonfiction. I love reading about journalism and about music and, you know, like just about the human condition. And I love a contemporary funny novel. That's definitely, I'd be just stuck onto those big time. And I think I kept that going all the way through my 20s. Loved reading that kind of stuff. Definitely.
And in Esther, you touch on some, but you touch on a lot of like heavier themes. You know, there's loss, there's depression, addiction. I mean, there's a whole lovely galaxy of those kind of themes. I don't want to pry, so if I am, tell me to sling my hook. But did you draw on personal things in your own life for Esther? And if so, what book did you go to then, you know, for anything that maybe was difficult in your life?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know what? I mean, I've never broken up my marriage to run after an actor. That's never happened. And I didn't experience the loss that Esther experienced. And I had to make sure to get the emotional truth of that right. So I did speak to people who had gone through that. And, you know, I inhabited a lot of online spaces to kind of get this super fan culture down, you know. I think maybe the only thing that I really wrote from personal experience was that moment when Esther finds out she's pregnant, you know, and I do remember that being a really profound moment. So I drew on my own experience for that, you know, and like I say, there was a little bit of the industry kind of crept in. And obviously, as a journalist, I've been following celebrity culture for 20 years now. So I found it easy to write. There's a lot of journalism, you know, newspaper reports and interviews. They were very easy to write. So I found that made it easy. But everything else was fairly, you know, from the back of the brain, whatever part of the brain does the imagination goings on. But yeah, no, thankfully, my family wasn't like Esther. My mother was not like Esther's mom. And my marriage isn't like hers either, you know, so thank God. But yeah. Okay. And then it's funny, the book, you know, and I mean, that's not to say I've not gone through stuff in my life, you know, but the one book that I remember reading when my mother was dying, I think, right? And I read Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed. And then as a companion to that, Wild by Cheryl Strayed, you know, which is the book where she walks the Pacific Coast Highway after her mother dies. Do you remember this book?
No, I haven't read either.
God, she's just, how do I say this? It was made into a film with Reese Witherspoon at one point, and it was sort of, did she win an Oscar? Maybe there was definitely Oscar nominated. But Cheryl Strayed lost her mother at a very early age and just lost her way in life. And, you know, I think she, you know, took drugs and she left a very steady husband and, you know, kind of ended up having a few kind of dalliances and maybe crisis pregnancies and things like that. And it was all just kind of feeding into a bit of a mess. And she decided to take herself out on the Pacific Coast Highway for, I think, was something like a 3,000 kilometer journey. Okay. And again, she just walked out for life and walked into another phase. But it's got a phenomenal sense of place. I mean, you're actually feeling it on your feet as you're reading it, you know, because she's talking about, you know, she starts off and she hasn't got the right shoes, maybe, or she is overpacked. You know, she's got all these books in her bag, you know, and it's a phenomenal book. But she did write, there was a compendium of her Agony Aunt columns that she wrote for The Rumpus, a US magazine called The Rumpus. And she is just she's so warm. It's like so motherly. And the way she writes, I mean, there's a very famous one that she wrote called Write Like a Motherfucker. Am I allowed to say that? Yes. But she's telling somebody who's like, I know I'm a brilliant writer, but I can't write. And she just says it with such empathy. And, you know, she's not like, cop yourself on there now. Who do you think you are? It's like, darling, yeah, you need to do it, you know? And her approach is just, she's just very, very warm and very, very human. And it's, I remember needing that at that time. You know, when you lose your mother, the world does drop by a few degrees, you know? And I remember just feeling the blanket of Cheryl Strayed's warmth at that time. It's gorgeous.
Oh, I'm definitely going to look her up. That sounds phenomenal. Really, really great. So that's maybe a book that was kind of with you at a particular time in your life, the loss of your mother. Are you a rereader, Tanya? Did you go back to books? Or are you, from what I'm getting from you on how you read, I'm imagining maybe not. Is it, would you go back to something like if you need to have a bit of a giggle or some solace? Or do you maybe pick up the new thing instead?
I mean, my to-be-read pile is, if it fell down on top of me, I'd end up in a hospital, right? It's forever teetering. And it's just terrible. There were a couple of books that I love to reread. I love a comfort read. There's a book, no one knows of this book, right? And I think it's incredible. It's called The Girls by Laurie Lansons. It is a story of a pair of conjoined twins living in rural Ontario. Wow. In a sort of unspecified, maybe in mid-19th century, you know, unspecified time. But one of them receives a terminal diagnosis, which means they are both going to die, obviously. So the book is alternating between they're obviously writing diary entries about this situation, you know, and one of them is very, very spirited and feisty. And then the other is much quieter and more reflective, you know, and she just does the most, she obviously did an incredible amount of research on the phenomenon of being a conjoined twin, because you are reading it and feeling the, you know, I won't even say not the inconvenience, but you are feeling the physical sensation of being joined to another person forever. It is a really, really phenomenal reading experience. So I go back to that every couple of years because I just think it's a masterclass in immersive writing. Like I say, you are there in rural Ontario with them. I think the first line of that book is, "I've never looked into my sister's eyes." I mean, from there on, I was
Oh my God, what a first line.
From the first line, I was absolutely hooked. Fabulous.
Okay, that's definitely going on the list. Wow. Tanya, I know you have, this is your debut novel that you've published, but I want to ask you a question. So this could be about anything published or also unpublished that you have written yourself, your own work, your own book. So this could be from anywhere. If your house was on fire, which book that you have written, published or unpublished, would you pull out?
Oh, that is a phenomenal question. Probably the one I'm writing now, because it would be a terrible shame to let that succumb to a fire or founder in a fire. Yeah, I mean, it would be a terrible waste of work if that were to just disappear into thin air, you know?
Are we allowed to ask what the next book is?
Well, I've been told to sort of keep counsel on it, but what I can say about it, right, is that it is much like Esther. I mean, and it's a 30-something woman as well who maybe just goes down a rabbit hole. But it is about how online communities inform offline behavior. How's that sound?
Oh, that's nice.
Give you that.
Yes.
And I mean, I love writing about women. I love writing about the human condition. I love writing about the darker corners of being a woman, you know. So that's something that definitely interests me. Again, you know, trying to keep it on the right side of light and funny and all that, you know. And it's harder than it looks, I think, you know, to be writing about loss and trauma and violence and all that, and people coming back going, "I read it in 3 hours, you know, and it was hilarious." I mean,
it's a bit like a nurse who really knows how to give an injection and you don't know what's happening. So this is, I hope you're going to answer this question, because some people, you know, get quite sort of, you know, "I couldn't possibly burn a book." It's obviously supposed to be a funny question. If there is a book that you would leave in your burning house and you just let it burn.
I won't mention any one specific title, but I do remember buying into a lot of the wellness titles, a lot of the "How to Lose a Stone in 4 weeks" kind of. I mean, I think every woman goes through a stage in their life where they just buy into all that crap. And so I do have an embarrassing little collection of, you know, "Here's how to get thinner with absolutely no effort," you know, and I don't mind a wellness title, you know. But, you know, I don't know if you get too much. I think they can happily go in the fire.
Yes, I'll throw a few in there as well. That's great. The Hippothy diet. Goodbye. Okay, they are burning. And the last question before we get to talk properly about Esther is something you would save from your house that isn't a book or a beloved animal or a beloved human for that matter.
Oh my gosh. I have, you can't really see it in this room, but I have a phenomenal painting downstairs by an artist, a Wicklow artist called Ramon Cassan. It's huge and it's basically just dots, right? But there's a fantastic story behind it. My brothers used to run art auctions for charity. And I saw this in the catalogue and I want that one. That's the one I want. And I said this to my mum. Now, she was terminally ill at the time, you know, and I kept saying, I want this, you know, painting. We went to the art auction. And of course, I had Googled how to win auctions, what you need to do to get the lot. I really wanted this painting, right? So I was like, I'm going to go down the front. We were back, myself and my mum were down the back of the auction room. I went, I'm going to go down the back and I'm going to do this properly with my paddles. So down I went and I met another friend of mine who was like, oh, I really want the Ramon Kassan. And I was like, well, tough, because I'm having it. So smell you later. Anyway, it started up and myself and my friend started going like the clappers with the paddles. So we got to about 300-400 euro and I could feel her kind of waning a little bit. And I went, oh, I'm going to get this now. So I went, you know, kept going. And then someone down the back started bidding and I was like, oh God, I hate this. And I was told in my research, you're not to look back at the person who you're bidding against. You know, you're just to sort of, you know, be cool as a cucumber. So we kept going and I think we got up to about 800-900 euro. And I was like, I'd better stop because I cannot afford it if I win it, you know? So I let it go. The person down the back won the painting. So I was a little bit disappointed. I went, oh, that's crap. And I went back to my mum and she went, when you were in the toilet, I bid on that painting for you. And I was like, mother, I was up the front. She obviously forgot I'd said anything. I think I might have gone to the loo and come back, you know, but she thought I was still in the toilet. So, and of course, she thought this was absolutely hilarious. So, and everyone else did, you know, because it was for charity, it was fine, you know. But, oh my God. So that's definitely coming with me.
Oh, that's coming with you. And she gifted you a story there as well. That's just gorgeous. I love that. I love that. Yes. Right. Now we've gotten to Esther and I know you're going to read for us in a bit. But before we do, I mean, I'm sure everybody who is listening kind of knows the premise of Esther is now following you. But just in case there are people out there who haven't heard about the book, maybe just give us a little flavour of what it's about.
Sure. Well, Esther is a woman in her 30s, right? She's Irish and living in London. And, you know, she's in a so-so marriage. She's in a job in finance she doesn't really understand. And she's got the kind of friends that you just stick with, you know, through circumstances or through necessity. They're not really her, you know, best friends. And I think this is something that, you know, people who are, you know, transplanted out of their hometowns can maybe relate to, you know. So she's in London. And of course, it all looks great on Facebook in the year 2010, 2011. So she's like, well, if it looks okay to everyone else, maybe it's fine. You know, I don't mind. So she gets pregnant and she experiences a very, a much wanted child. And she experiences a loss. And this plunges her into a sort of depression, causes hairline fracture in her marriage. And while all this is going on, her friends are sort of gaining ground on her as well a little bit personally. They're also becoming pregnant and getting married and she can't really handle it. You know, she finds it really hard to kind of get in on their wins. So she starts fancying a Canadian actor that she just meets by chance in Victoria Park. And he's kind of regular looking guy, but he's got beautiful eyes. And she starts sort of the way we all do. We, you know, a bit of light Googling, look on the IMDb. Oh yeah, he's a Scorpio, whatever. And soon she's kind of making it part of her regime every day, just sort of check in on Ted. And, you know, before long, and I think this is very common. And so you would not believe how few people will say, yeah, I've done this. They're like, what is she doing? But, you know, the line between fantasy and reality just starts to blur. And she's in this imaginary relationship and she retreats into the beauty of this imaginary relationship in her mind to escape the reality of her life, which is really bleak at that time. And of course, in any imaginary relationship, when you're playing both, you know, both parts of the relationship, I mean, it's going to be gorgeous. You know, your love interest is going to be say all the right things, you know. So this happens. And anyway, she falls in with the Tedettes, who are Ted's super fans. And of course, they all aid and abet each other into this sort of weird feeding frenzy of fandom. And then there's a story, basically, this is where I stop now, but he has a supermodel girlfriend. He starts dating a supermodel. And this is the point where Esther goes, nope, not going to happen. He's mine. This is my soulmate. And they're just, this is all a showmance. So I need to go to Canada and course correct this. So off she goes. And basically the rest of the book is her trying to get, it's a bit of a cat and mouse, you know, her trying to meet Ted. And of course, it being the year 2010 and Facebook being what it is, she manages to get very close to him very quickly. Mm.
And it's brilliant because her own reasoning just seems to, you know, she rationalizes all of this and it's sort of growing exponentially, you know, and you start reading, you go, hang on a second. But you can see how she herself, these are the logical next steps, you know, and it sort of all becomes quite, well, of course she's thinking about it. And I loved, you know, you were talking about the she builds the fantasy in her, but she has dialogue and stuff with Ted. And I love some of the kind of fantasy she has, like lifted directly from some movies. You know, I love the one where, I can't remember, it was like, she pictures herself in the kitchen, you know, she's making something, some brunch or whatever, you know, and Ted comes and says, you know, I have to go out with the guys and, you know, gives her a kiss in the cheek. What have I done to deserve you? And it's just so, oh my God.
Juvenile, yeah.
Yeah.
And just, cliche.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
And she's just, but yeah, it's so, oh yeah. Anyway, I'll not keep on saying that. It's such a great book. I mean, flew through it and yeah. Well done. But you're going to read a passage from us for us now. Which sort of part of the novel are you going to read from? Like, where are we with Esther?
I'm going to read the chapter in which I suppose she finds out she's pregnant, right? And I'm going to just go as long, maybe put your hand up and let me know when I've kind of gone far enough, okay? And bearing in mind now, I am no audiobook narrator, so this could go wildly wrong, but sure, we'll crack on and see how we go.
We'll crack on. Brilliant.
I can't stop thinking about the stories the stuff from our bodies can tell. A drop of blood can tell you if you're 3% Spanish or have a secret cousin you never knew about on the other side of the world. Semen can help create a whole other life. Breast milk can keep a person alive. Sweat helps us attract someone, supposedly. Even saliva can tell a story or two about us. And piss can utterly change your life. I'm Googling, do tears carry DNA information, while I wait for one line or two lines. This is how I determined I am that it will be a single line again. I go into the living room to watch a whole episode of Deal or No Deal. The contestant has gone and won £300 by the time I remember the test still sitting on the lip of the bath. I go to check it, expecting to see the single red line that will let me get on with the rest of my day. But the second line is even stronger and redder than the control one, almost defiant in its redness. I feel the floor wobble beneath me. This is pure Alice in Wonderland stuff, walking through one door, mainly to see if you can, then turning around to find the door, the way back out, vanished. I know I meant to feel some sort of euphoria. Yes, we were trying and trying, almost to a point where there was not much between Johnny and I than chat about mucus and cycles and implantation. And now we have moved from using all the language into a new reality, a whole new place. All that hope has gone and created something. Well, Jesus. For a brief, fluttering cicada of a moment, I feel a little bit proud of Johnny and I, but a chase of something else. A surety that things will never be the same again, and maybe that's not such a good thing, creates a strange aftertaste. What about all the stuff I wanted to do? Would I have done it, pregnancy or not? Something else bears down on me. I have 18 years, possibly more, of hard, unpaid labour ahead of me. I will probably never have a day without worry ever again. I feel immediately wrecked, so much so that I once thought would be a euphoric moment becomes a take to the bed moment. It's a weird brew of feelings, this guilt that I wasn't more immediately happy at the two lines, and the terror that I'm nowhere near ready for what comes next. What business have I, a person who thinks ungenerous things about almost everyone around her, to be in this position? I send annoying baby toys to new parents for kicks. I glare at screechy babies in cafes. What sane world would entrust me with my own one? The more I think of it, this could well be having a very human and understandable reaction to the idea of a screaming, shitting thing entering your life. In quick succession, I think of the mums on the goat milk mile and their glossy, satiating happiness. I think of the other women whose cohort I was in only a few minutes ago. The ones that maybe even want this even more than me and are denied it month after month, their hopes dashed with a horrid little single line. I'm still heady with wonderment about how this one moment has happened right after Deal or No Deal has changed everything in my life when I hear the scrape of Johnny's key in the front door downstairs. We may be already married, but this means we are truly, definitely in it for the long haul.
You've been listening to Tanya Sweeney, whose debut novel, Esther Is Now Following You, is out now with Penguin. See you all next time.